Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Rodriguez, a PhD candidate in history at Vanderbilt University. Today I'll talk with Professor Andrew Grant Wood about his edited volume, The Business of Leisure, Tourism History in Latin America and the Caribbean, just out with the University of Nebraska Press. I'll also be joined by Professors Anna Romo and Elizabeth Manley, who each have essays in the volume. The book's 12 chapters look at the political, economic, and cultural dimensions of tourism in the region, and its relationship to nationalism, imperialism, development, and many other themes. The volume also provides a new way of understanding the relationship between the United States and Latin America during the 20th century, showing how Latin American and U.S. elites and policymakers used tourism to create lucrative business deals, shape domestic and international politics, and bolster exceptionalist national histories. Wood is the Stanley Rutland Professor of History of American History at the University of Tulsa. Romo is Associate Professor of History at Texas State University. And Manley is the Kellogg Endowed Associate Professor of History at Xavier University. Drew, I wanted to begin by asking you about the origins of this edited volume. I always feel like there's a really interesting origin story for an edited volume, how people get this idea, and also your own background in studying the history of tourism and how you're kind of thinking about that has changed after having organized this volume.
Well, thanks for that. The origins more or less date back to a volume I did with my colleague Dina Berger on various tourism histories to Mexico and relating to Greater Mexico. And I forget the precise date, maybe 2010 or something like that. That book was published by Duke University Press. And that was really my first venture into tourism studies and more specifically tourism history. Dina and I and a couple of other people, Alex Zaragoza, Barry Carr, and John Walton from the UK, BNA Castellanos, participated for a little while in what was called a Berkeley Tourism History Workshop. I think it was hosted by Alex. We traveled out to Berkeley and convened 2 years in a row. And at that time, the group of us engaged in a very ambitious survey of the literature and bringing together, information, contacts on people, not just in the U.S. and in the U.K., of course, but in Mexico, in Chile. In Argentina and elsewhere, different folks who were working on various aspects of tourism history. And really out of that venture, which I was very fortunate to be invited to, I was able to inform myself and get a sense of the field and the potential for a volume such as the one we're talking about today. So that's part of the backstory, at least from my own vantage point.
Great, thanks, Drew. I wanted to the book is divided into four sections. Could you just talk a little bit about how you decided to divide it in that way? And for Anna and Beth, in terms of how do you see your kind of pieces fitting in within those subheadings in the volume?
Well, I'm going to try to be very brief here, because when one looks at the table of contents, as I am right now, you know, it's basically divided into a couple of different chronological groupings. And then within that, there are a couple of chapters, Mark Rice's chapter on Peru, my chapter on Veracruz, Mexico, and sort of Mexican mid-century tourism more generally, Ken Kincaid's piece on this very interesting episode in Ecuadorian history. Anyways, these different chapters, as well as Rodrigo Booth's chapter on Viña del Mar, these all deal with what we call domestic or national tourism. So that's a subset and a particular, I think, strong theme in the volume. But of course, it's not the only theme. Subsequently, there are chapters perhaps a little bit more international in scope. Evan Ward's piece on Guatemala, Beth Manley's piece on the Dominican Republic. And then subsequently, we have a couple of pieces, I think, which are quite tantalizing. Rocio Gomez's piece on Zacatecas and the tourism centered on people visiting and going into the historic silver mine there. And then Felix Manuel Burgos' piece on dark tourism related to the narcos tours that have developed, mushroomed perhaps, in Medellin, significantly as a result of the success of the Netflix narco series. So, you know, I mention a couple, but not all of the different chapters, which I will spare you. But I'll pass the wand here to Anna and Beth, and they can add to my sort of basic overview description of how the volume is structured.
Anna?
Well, I guess I'm in the international section, and in some ways that's what probably, you know, burgeoning international travel is the first part. And I think in some ways that's probably what people are thinking about when they think about tourism. My guess is that when Drew invited me, I think I remember that he had hoped I would write more on Brazil, which is where my research center is on Salvador. And in fact, I am finishing a project on tourism and race in Salvador, looking at kind of visual iconography in that area. But as part of that project, I felt like I had to understand the broader international currents. And so that pushed me toward understanding what the Pan-American Union was doing during this time. And so I was trying to kind of flesh out for myself and hopefully for others, the kind of inter-American interest in tourism that was developing over the 20th century. And so I think that first section kind of tackles what, in terms of international travel, probably what most people are thinking of in tourism. But I do think that's where this volume is really kind of, you know, forging new ground here, and that the second part is dealing with domestic tourism, which really hasn't gotten enough attention. And then we have kind of more historians looking at more modern episodes as well. So I guess my fit is into a more traditional kind of framework of tourism and trying to understand how it unfolded with different international players involved in the process.
And Beth?
Yeah, I think I really like the organization of the different essays, as there's such a diversity of them, but they've been kind of organized so well, both chronologically and thematically. And it my piece, which looks at the development of tourism in the Dominican Republic, which is where I've done the majority of my work thus far, it makes sense that it sort of goes into this post-war and developing tourism across the second half of the 20th century, because when you look at Caribbean tourism specifically, things really begin to take off in that post-war period. And it's kind of a critical moment in which Caribbean tourism starts really to kind of develop the boom that will come later. And specifically in the case of the Dominican Republic, it's really not until after the fall of dictator Rafael Trujillo that the tourism business becomes kind of central to some of the things that the government is doing to advance the economy and kind of develop a national industry under Joaquin Balaguer, the successor to Trujillo. And so in beginning a larger project on women in tourism, I felt as though I wanted to start in the Dominican Republic because it was the place I knew best, even though I wanted to kind of spread larger across the Caribbean. But I also kind of wanted to begin where it began. I think that's sort of logical. So I started looking at the materials of the Balaguer administration and trying to understand the ways in which they were promoting this new industry, particularly in light of Cuba and the fact that, you know, after 1959, many of these Caribbean nations are kind of scrambling to take up the mantle of that. Not that it was the most desirable, but that they knew that there could be a place for them as this playground for North American and European tourists, and what that might, you know, help them be able to do for the economy and other things. And so I guess that is, it makes sense for me to be in that section, certainly.
Yeah. Thanks, Beth. I want to come back to a lot of what all of you have mentioned, but first, you know, as I was reading the volume, I think I agree, Beth, that the organization has done very well, and certainly the thematic groupings make a lot of sense to me. But like any good edited volume, there are certain themes, I think, that run through the volume and connect many of the essays. And two of those that I found particularly interesting, especially in your pieces, is this idea of historical erasure in tourism. So the ways in which tourism is shaped, the way the tourism tends to erase either indigenous history or the labor exploitation, these kinds of things, as a way to market a particular destination to make it more appealing, or to perhaps not necessarily erase the history, but to manipulate and sanitize it. And this is something that comes up, especially in the dark tourism essays, but I think we see this in other instances as well. And then the second theme that I see throughout the volume in your pieces is this tension between promoting indigenous traditions and the simultaneous desire to modernize. I guess the question there is, were these necessarily mutually exclusive? And what did that kind of tension between modernization and indigenous culture do to the kind of national the cultures in many of these places, the playing out between those two things. So I'll just kind of open this up. If anybody wants to comment on either of these things, how you see it fitting into your piece or just the volume in general, so the historical erasure and the tension between indigenous and modernization, traditions and modernization.
I will comment just very briefly, because I think those are very insightful observations. And I certainly don't have a fully developed response, but what strikes me about places and people engaged in quote unquote tourism development is the fact that there is a staging process inherent in the development of the industry and the infrastructure and all of the construction, both literal and figurative, involved in presenting a place, and then, of course, preparing a place for hosting tourists, either national tourists or international tourists, or both. You know, there are a variety of themes that stretch significantly here. I won't name all of them. My work has been fairly, I think, sort of foundational in terms of looking, for example, at Veracruz, which is never really has been a hotspot of international tourism. It's not like Acapulco, which has managed somewhat amazingly, at least in previous decades, maybe not so much today, to attract an international jet set of people. But in any case, I argue in the volume that Veracruz is still a place where tourism development was undertaken in the hope, of course, of making money and of drawing not so much sexy New Yorkers from Manhattan or whoever, people from Paris to come, but more middle class Mexicans who are and continue to look for a place to go outside of their neighborhood, their home, and if they can't afford to get on a bus or drive over to the coast, they can have a lot of fun and a quite reasonable middle class vacation. This notion of upgrading, of preparing, as I said, of developing and marketing. Facilitating and hosting tourism, domestic national tourism, there's a history there. It may not be all that exciting, but there's a history nonetheless in developing the infrastructure and the capability of tourism. Is there erasure? That's a provocative notion. I think, of course, there is to some degree, simply in the repackaging, say, of local and regional histories, heritage, identities, customs, and all of this kind of thing, both indigenous and non-indigenous. And Veracruz has its own relatively unique blend of African, Caribbean, European, and indigenous traditions and identities and so on. And when one looks at the way Veracruz has and continues to be marketed, those identities, of course, are identified and represented in an attractive manner. And I'm not really an expert on these sorts of themes necessarily, but they're present, I think, certainly in the materials that I've worked with as a historian, and of course too in any number of places at different times.
Thanks, Drew. I want to pick up on, you've been talking, I think it's interesting you're talking about marketing, and this is perhaps, this is a nice segue for a question I have for Anna about this, which is, in your piece, Anna, you're looking at the Bulletin of the Pan-American Union, and you're doing a close reading, a lot of really interesting sources, issues of the Bulletin of the Pan-American Union, which is promoting tourism to Latin America. And, a lot of times we see the issues of the Pan-American Union or graphics that you reproduce that are trying to in some way communicate or translate Latin American culture to an American audience or an English-speaking audience. And so I guess I was thinking there's some kind of, in that translating process, a lot is lost, and perhaps we might say a lot is erased, depending on how extreme it is. Could you just talk about that aspect of your piece, and maybe just give us a little background on the Pan-American Union?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this both of these questions are so interesting, but this question of erasure, I do find particularly interesting and particularly important for understanding tourism, and I think. In my piece, I guess I'm looking at how the Pan-American Union began as a group that intended to kind of promote commercial interest and particularly pushed by the United States, but embraced by Latin Americans as well, intended to kind of tighten commercial networks. And there began to be a more cultural agenda of understanding as time went on. And so somewhere between these two things of encouraging commerce and fostering cultural proximity and understanding came tourism, which was kind of seen as a solution for both of those problems, in that you could modernize your economy, you could bring in new revenue with this tourist economy is what Latin American elites were hoping. And on the other hand, they also hope that kind of by getting people to Latin America, that they would foster a greater understanding and move past some of the stereotypes perhaps that Americans had or that people from the US had rather. And I think in the irony in some ways came from the fact that to promote themselves, they often resorted to some of the same stereotypes that they were probably trying to get away from. And some of these included a kind of, a land that kind of harbored central traditions, particularly indigenous traditions. And this is an interesting place to think about erasure, because on one hand, at the turn of the century, there was certainly an emphasis on modernity as we see across Latin America. And so even talking about indigenous culture as something to come and experience in Latin America was, I think, a product of these nationalizing elite and these modern, kind of the new modernism that was spreading across Latin America more generally. But in terms of silences, I think one of the important silences to talk about here would be that Black populations in Latin America were never embraced in the same way or talked about in the same way in terms of promotion, in promoting a given region. Now, I mean, there are exceptions to this, and I think the place I'm most familiar with is Salvador Bahia in Brazil, and I think that's really one of the most important exceptions. But I just attended a very interesting panel on anti-Blackness that Bianca Primo organized for the AHA, and so part of that panel was kind of talking about all of the erasure of Blackness in Latin America, and I think we can certainly see that for the most part, even in the promotion of these indigenous traditions, it was always indigenous rather than Afro-Latin traditions that were being kind of called out and drawn upon. So I think in terms of erasures, the Blackness in Latin America is really important there. And Beth may have more to say on that with Dominican Republic too. But so that would be one thing. But I think that this idea of, how do you, there's a tension in tourism, right? Which is that you have to really focus on only the positive aspects of an area. I mean, you're not going to bring people in by, you know, having a realistic heart-to-heart conversation with people about poverty or hunger or inequality. And so to some extent, of course, that's understandable. You know, you're going to get a rose-colored vision of a place in tourism promotion. But I think what makes it interesting is that that rose-colored vision changes depending on the place and depending on who's promoting it, right? So that's where I think historians can come in and really do some interesting things by saying, okay, yes, of course, we're going to get this whitewashed version, literally, in many cases, of a location in tourism promotion. But what's the agenda here, and how does it reflect kind of these local concerns, and how does it reflect these local demands, regional demands? How does it respond to international concerns? I think that's where you can get into these layers of understanding that become really interesting and complicated. And so in the case of the Pan American Union, I found that, yes, the Pan American Union and its U.S. side was often kind of resorting to simplified ideas of indigenous culture to promote the region. But interestingly enough, so were the Latin American elites who were promoting their regions. They were also resorting to these simplified versions of indigenous culture to promote the region as well. And so as much as we might want to see it as, you know, there's this imperialistic vision of Latin America that comes through from these elites and is imposed on Latin America, we have to see it as a more balanced and negotiated space where, in fact, Latin American elites are participating in these same processes. And you know, if we look at, I mean, you know, I think this is very clear in Mexico, as I'm sure Drew could talk about, but, you know, we could talk about the way that indigenous cultures are drawn upon for tourism purposes and then forgotten when it comes to public policy or poverty programs. I mean, I think this is a very clear and important trend to think about, is how we can get these celebrations of culture in the realm of tourism that bring out very stark differences in the actual treatment of those same populations within the country's borders or within the region's borders. And I think that is part of that tension that you're pointing to. You mentioned this tension between kind of promoting indigenous traditions and modernization. And I think that these locations saw tourism as a way to modernize, as a way to modernize their economies. In many cases, economies that had been trapped in primary exports or traditional agricultural pursuits. And so tourism is seen as this new way, this new path of out of those backward economies. But the irony then is that to get into this modern economy, you have to promote the traditions that you're in some ways threatening or perhaps altering with this modernization process. And I don't mean to imply that modernization is always antagonistic to traditions or that there is such a thing as traditions which are, you know, untouchable and can't be changed. But there is a tension there. And I think you were getting at that in your question. I think it's a very interesting dynamic, right? Is how do you both, I mean, just the whole idea of tradition, you know, we have to remember that these are invented traditions to begin with, and then how do you promote these invented traditions? Do they become static in the process? I think that's kind of, you know, a difficult thing to unravel, right? So I guess in my study of the Pan American Union, what I thought was interesting was that in many ways there was a Latin American modernist and modernizing elite that suddenly, really in the 20s and 30s, I think, begins to see these indigenous traditions as not a hindrance to modernity, in some ways, at least in this tourism realm, but as the key to attracting this new modern economy. And so that's an interesting tension and dynamic, for sure.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and I think what you've said there about how historical erasure can provide us a way of understanding the kind of competing and contested interests of elites and non-elites in domestic settings, and also how countries want to portray themselves or interact with elites or policymakers in other countries is really interesting. And something, and Beth, I found in your piece, there's this kind of glorification of the colonial past, the Dominican Republic's relationship with colonialism, and a glorification of it for the purposes of tourism, and a kind of an exceptionalist argument made as well about the kind of unique relationship that Dominican Republic had in relation to colonialism. Could you just talk a little bit about this theme of historical erasure in your piece?
Yeah, absolutely. I think these two themes that you've pulled out are both really central to the work in this book, but also intertwined. And in my head, I'm kind of seeing them come together. When I was looking through a lot of the materials on tourism development in the Dominican Republic, I kept, you know, of course, seeing these references to Christopher Columbus, and the one that, you know, sort of struck me the most intensely was an advertisement for Hertz, the car rental, that said had a picture of the Columbus statue that's in front of the cathedral in Santo Domingo, and said, "Chris missed out on a lot," right? As though if he had had a car, he could have, you know, seen much more of the island. And I thought, gosh, this is fascinating. And the more I dug, the more I found this narrative that was being pushed by officials, private and public, that enticed visitors to come and kind of explore in the manner of Columbus, right? That the Dominican Republic had this unique, as you say, story to tell, drawing on, you know, these lists of firsts, the first cathedral, the first hospital, the first school, et cetera, and reminding potential visitors of their ability to kind of retrace the path of Columbus, right? Obviously, this narrative is sanitizing in the sort of extreme, right? And it paints this picture of an idyllic encounter, right, that erases all the indigenous population. It erases everything that happened within that colonial period that was destructive, and just kind of presents this idea that the visitor can come and explore and discover in the same way. And so I wanted to really think about what that meant for the development of an industry that would last, you know, as we know, into the present. And so I really wanted to you know, kind of emphasize how this idea of a flattened narrative of national belonging ran from the beginning of the promotion of tourism, right? It continues. And I love, Anna, thank you for reminding me of that panel that I was also at the AHA, because the anti-blackness, the thematics of anti-blackness, right, ran through the history of the Dominican Republic. And this is yet another place in which we see that, right? Those individuals that the tourist will encounter are exotic. They are interesting, right? But they are not black. They are not, you know, they're not talked about in any kind of dignified way, but they're these sort of others, right, that are enticing and engaging. And so I think digging into the ways in which the industry is sold helps us to kind of unpack some of those legacies of anti-blackness, right, in the Dominican Republic in my case, but across the region. And so that is a thing that I really want to be able to use this history to be able to do. But I think also inherent in that is the tension that you talk about, because part of what is being promoted, and the more I dig into the earlier history, the more I find this, is the tension between the primitive and the modern. And not that there is sort of that this tension exists, but in fact, it is inherent to the selling of tourism. That what you are coming to experience as a potential visitor is precisely the tension between the quote unquote primitive and the modern, right? You are going to come and visit a place that has hotels that will make you comfortable and cars that will allow you to drive around the island, but you will also experience a place that somehow was stopped in time, right? That you are exploring like Columbus. And I recently have been reading these columns from a woman named Ruby Black, who was reporting on Puerto Rico in the 1930s. And she traveled with Eleanor Roosevelt to Puerto Rico to kind of inspect and conduct a study, as she said the First Lady was doing. And in one of her articles after the fact, she said of Puerto Rico that the island had, quote, wealth and poverty, beauty and squalor, lush plenty and starvation, astounding industry and inertia that showed themselves side by side to Mrs. Roosevelt, right? From all of the, you know, seeing this reporting and that the very juxtaposition of between that kind of idea of primitive and modern was central to the sale, at least in from what I'm seeing of the Caribbean, right? That tension is central to the product that is being put on offer. And so keeping that, you know, sort of at the forefront of how we're understanding this, not just that there was kind of they were there opposing each other, but that they were part of what was to be attractive about these places, I think is really important.
Yeah, Beth, that advertisement that you mentioned, that Hertz advertisement, when I encountered that, I almost couldn't believe it. It was really just quite funny and insane to see that kind of weird marketing strategy there. And yeah, but very telling as well about this kind of theme of sanitizing this past colonial history. I'd like to move on to something that's related to what we've just been talking about. You know, as you read through the volume, you get a sense of, one, how tourism has evolved globally in terms of the centers of tourism, but also in terms of the types of tourism. So in your introduction, Drew, you kind of give a nice overview of different types of tourism. So, you know, sex tourism, dark tourism or disaster tourism. Of course, you have this kind of luxurious tourism that we associate with many places in the Caribbean. So there's this whole range of ways in which people engage with tourism, and have each, you know, people having different sets of expectations and different experiences that they want. But I've noticed that throughout all of these, because we're trying to think, how could we, you know, relate all of these? There is something like the idea of authenticity seems to run through all of these. So, you know, if you're interested in dark tourism, you know, you want like a gritty, authentic experience in some way, or you want to recreate some kind of gritty, authentic experience. And the same is, you know, and with your piece, Beth, there's a kind of, again, this idea of wanting to experience what it was like, this authentic, you know, colonial experience. And then there, of course, there are other ones which are just pure luxury in there. It's, you know, perhaps the authenticity element is not as strong, but perhaps there's kind of an exoticization element, people wanting to interact with at least a representation of what another culture is like, but do it with all of the material comforts that they have, perhaps in their home country. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on, but geographically, of course, the first piece shows, you know, we had this idea of the Grand Tour in Europe. And so Europe was, of course, a hub for tourism. But then we see kind of the geography of tourism shifting across through the volume. So maybe we could start with Andrew here. Could you just say a little bit about when you're writing your introduction, trying to think of the different types of tourism? How do you, could you tell us a little bit about that kind of taxonomy of tourism and the different desires of tourists?
Yeah, thank you. If I may, just step back for a moment, because I wanted to just add to what Anna and Beth were saying, and particularly Beth with this very interesting marketing of tourism in the Dominican Republic. And my comment here is that in a number of the essays here, Mark Rice's piece on Peru and these national hotels that were developed, as well as Evan Ward's piece on Guatemala and the mm-hmm. area in and around Tikal as an archaeological heritage site that was developed in the interest of promoting international travel. Rocio Gomez's piece on the mine tour in Zacatecas, and my own experience in Veracruz, similarly, a very historic place, and a place among others where history, events in the past are repackaged. And of course, sanitized, and the proper amount of erasure and refitting undertaken, so as to offer tourists this encounter. I liked how you put that, an encounter with a representation. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't mean to sound arrogant, because this is what motivates me, to be honest. As a tourist myself, and part of the backstory of this volume is thinking about and thinking critically about what we do as North Americans, as scholars, when we travel, when we go to conferences, when we engage in quote unquote professional development, and we don't like to think of ourselves as sort of uncritical, unsophisticated consumers, quite the contrary, but consumers and tourists we are nonetheless. And so if I get to go to the Dominican Republic or to Brazil or to Cuba or Canada or Chile or wherever, you know, there are sites that are meaningful to me, even though I realize that, you know, they're being developed and socially and culturally constructed and so on and so forth. Different types of tourism. This is something that to me is really interesting, as a tourist, as a scholar, as a historian, all of the above identities, all of those hats I wear at different times. And, you know, the work of Dean McConnell and of John Urey, for many of us is important because it puts that mirror right up in front of our faces. I'll just own it myself, my face, and requires, you know, a larger perspective than might otherwise be the case. But wow, different kinds of tourism, they seem to be metastasizing, or better, perhaps more positively, sort of growing in all sorts of interesting ways. I sort of come down in the introduction in my own grumpy way on the side of sustainable tourism. I don't know if that's even possible. And this whole COVID pandemic is certainly an opportunity to reflect and to pause and to really ask ourselves if we need to get on those jet planes quite as much as we think we do. You know what I'm saying? And there's interesting observations, in fact, from outer space. And I was reading just the other day, someone was saying they could hear the Earth in a different sort of way. We could hear natural features of the Earth, whereas when the planes and the cars and the buses were all doing their thing pre-COVID, those more natural planetary sounds were drowned out by humankind and human society. But you know, the ethics of tourism, the questionable sustainability of tourism, mass tourism, any kind of tourism. You know, I'm rambling a little bit here, but there are many, many different reasons why people travel and become and practice, become tourists and practice tourism. And it's really not for me to judge. Ultimately, I'd like to think, as I just said, that we as a society, if there is such a sort of notion, that we could be more gentle, we could be more kind, we could be more compassionate and thoughtful and mindful in how we consume. And there's a hell of a lot of people out there who, and we quote quite famously Jamaica Kincaid, who says there's a lot of people who just don't have the opportunity to even think about tourism, much less undertake. And many of these people we see from the taxi window, the bus window, you know, the tour window, as we're going about our little adventures, catching a glimpse of Columbus's, you know, first church, or in my case, Cortez home in La Antigua, Veracruz. I mean, you could just walk up and walk right into the remains, the ruins of Cortez's first home. It's not a crowded sight, by the way, and hopefully it never will be such. But in any case, you catch my drift. The ethics are to be considered, I think, and hopefully people will, not to be preachy, but hopefully people will take that with however many grains of salt as they read about different histories in different places. We certainly don't cover all of Latin America and the Caribbean, but we have a good sampling of places and processes and themes, as you have very nicely pointed out.
Yeah, thanks for that, Drew. I guess, you know, I was just thinking as you were talking, you know, these different modes of tourism are not in any way mutually exclusive. And you often see, I think, in a given location, what either different that this the one location catering to different types of tourists, and also how one location, like let's say, I'll give you an example, which is like Cuba, the country I study, and you know, for Americans, there's a, now that, you know, Americans still can go to Cuba, even though some of the Obama era kind of opening up has been rolled back, but there's a certain appeal for Americans because it is was a forbidden place. So that's one kind of appeal. Of course, there is, for others, it might just be the fact that Cuba still has a centrally planned economy and it's a communist state. So that's perhaps another vector of tourism. And then if we think back historically, when, you know, U.S. Direct economic control of Cuba, you see a different kind of, mostly in this kind of exotic location type marketing in that earlier period, in the kind of luxurious accommodations. So even in this one place, we see many different modes of tourism operating, both historically and currently. And I think that's, yeah, a really fascinating thing. And perhaps also connects to this ethical question, thinking about how one is a tourist, what kind of habits and how they interact with the location they go to and the people there, and how they interact with the local economy, a whole set of very complicated questions. Anna or Beth, do you want to add anything there about this question of different types of tourism or even the ethical question, which I'm also interested in? Beth?
Yeah, I mean, I think we do, certainly the people that look at tourism, we do a lot of work, and I think it's important work to kind of think about these different categories, whether it's dark tourism, whether it's sex tourism, you know, heritage tourism, environmental tourism. I think these are very useful categories for analysis. And they are also very useful categories for promotion, marketing, and branding, right? And if you look at even sort of the Ministry of Tourism files for any given country, I haven't looked at it, for Jamaica, Dominican Republic, specifically, you see a lot of that evolution that we should be branding here, or we should be working on this. In the case of Jamaica, at one point they say, we're not getting enough honeymooners. And they put together a package that they're calling the Jamaican Dowry Collection, or promotion rather. And it's encouraging honeymooners. So these categories are useful in both of those kind of different ways, but on the ground, right, they sort of all blend together, right? I don't think people that are engaged in one kind or another, as people working in the industry necessarily are thinking about those things, right? And that those categories only go so far. I think it's, you know, central to say these are useful when we think about them analytically, but also does that, how much does that matter sort of when we think about how people experience being a part of this industry, which can be so intensely extractive.
Thanks, Beth. We're kind of coming up on the end of our time together, but what I wanted to end with is ask each of you, usually on the New Books Network, end with a question about what's your future? What are you working on now? What's the next project? But I wanted to ask it in a bit of a different way, which is, you know, each of you have written a piece in this volume. You've been thinking a lot about tourism. We've been talking about a lot of these themes. I want to ask what you've kind of learned in this about how you see this experience of thinking and writing about tourism as shaping perhaps some of your future work, whether it's directly about tourism or, you know, it's just a kind of new lens that you're going to use in looking at that work. What does that do for historians thinking about tourism and using that lens and analyzing that regardless of, you know, because as I suggested, and as we've been talking about, tourism touches on such a broad range of very important topics in Latin American history and indeed global history. So what does it do for us as historians and you specifically? Maybe we start with Anna.
Well, I mean, I think it is a great way it's a great lens to use on a broader way of thinking about history. And the project that I'm just finishing right now, and will be published by UT in the fall, is about I decided to look at all of these tourist guides that had developed for domestic tourism, actually, in Brazil, that came out of Salvador Bahia. And what I found interesting about the guides was that they were kind of, they provided a kind of microcosm of changing ideas of elites. You know, these were elites trying to promote their region, their city in the best ways possible. And they started out doing that at the turn of the century in terms of modernity and whiteness. And by the 30s, as nationalism began to kind of think about race and national roots in new ways, those promotions began to change. And when you get kind of the influence of more and more modernist currents in the art world and in intellectual worlds, the ideas of how to promote race as actually something central to Salvador became really different by the 50s. And that in turn was in part because of the mobilization of the Black population within Salvador itself. And so I started out interested in, okay, if we take tourist guides as kind of the ultimate synthesis of how a region wants to be perceived, how can we understand ideas of race and how they're changing over time through these texts? And for me, it was kind of an ideal barometer, right? Is that this is their way that they are trying to promote themselves to outsiders, to people who they hope are going to understand them. So what does that mean in terms of how are they going to own their Blackness? How are they going to own their experience with slavery and their reliance on slavery as a kind of fundamental part of their origin story of the city and of the region? And then what I discovered is that the text I was looking at, they were illustrated. And so I ended up kind of shifting gears to try to understand visual depictions of race and how those were being used in these tourist texts over time. And I kind of stepped backward to look at postcards and some other really great stuff in the 19th century that I had not anticipated looking at, but and kind of the history of photography and race in Brazil, which got me into some very interesting stuff. But for me, it kind of transformed into this other project, which has tourism at its core, but is actually, for me, more engaged with these ideas of race and ideas of Blackness and how those change over time. And so tourism kind of gave me a way to narrow my focus to a particular body of text and a particular body of production and kind of use that as a stable way to examine these ideas as they unfolded over the first part of the 20th century and into the later part of the century. And Salvador, I mean, the reason this story was interesting for me is that Salvador today really promotes itself as the Black heart of Brazil or as a center of the Afro-Latin diaspora and has a very powerful demographic presence of descendants of former enslaved people. And so there it's a really dynamic city. It's a really interesting city. And I wanted to kind of understand how these contemporary ideas of Salvador as a Black Mecca, is the way it's sometimes described, how those were crafted in some ways by promoters and marketers of the city, but who were also drawing on local trends and local participants. And there's a very dynamic process there at work. So I don't know if I'm going to keep going with tourism after this project or not, but it's been for me a really fun way to kind of use the lens of tourism to get into these other questions. And it's been really rewarding so far.
It sounds like a really fascinating project, and I look forward to reading it. Drew, what are you currently working on?
Well, I'll keep it short here. I'm writing a book on colonial Veracruz. But in terms of tourism, what I like about tourism is in part sort of what I like about the title of our book, The Business of Leisure. And I can't remember how I thought this up. It's sort of, Veblen-esque, theory of the leisure class or something like that. But I like the business part of it. And the reason is perhaps, when I mention to people, oh, well, I'm a historian or I work on Mexico, and, their eyes start to roll back in their head. Oh, that's nice, and so on and so forth. And for me, sure, I'm a dedicated historian. I'm passionate about it. But as a social animal and someone who lives in a neighborhood and in a city and has family connections to some extent, I want to talk and study something that really is important to people, and sort of from the old Jerry Maguire movie, show me the money. I want to show people, and I want to learn first and foremost for myself. I mean, that's really why I'm in this business, because I can learn new things and engage in some true professional and personal development rather than just punching the clock like I used to do. But if I can show people the money, and I think tourism is a way to do that, then again, I'm not out to necessarily command a huge audiences or anything like that. But when you start talking about money rather than ideology or sort of what for most people are very esoteric, historical, scholarly topics, then you've got something that is, robust and hopefully reasonably dynamic. So, I'm exploring right now the theme, the sort of sub-genre of medical health and wellness tourism, and it's quite a phenomenon, as you know, in the contemporary realm. And what I'm playing with and basically just trying to read about and learn for myself is how this so-called medical tourism and its various related sort of offshoots has a past, a historical past. And Beth and I have exchanged very preliminarily some ideas about people traveling to Mexico and the Caribbean in the late 19th century in search of wellness, in search of therapy, in search of vitality, and so on and so forth. It will remain to be seen, how this develops, but that's a theme that, apart from my sort of more, traditional sorts of pursuits, I'm working on now. So thank you for asking.
Yeah. Thank you, Drew. That sounds great too. And we'll just end with Beth here.
Thanks for that question. And I'm particularly grateful to the contributors and particularly to Drew, because this article was the first foray for me really into a larger history of women in tourism development in the Caribbean. And so I am still deep in this business of leisure as it is. And this allowed me to start kind of thinking through some of the major themes that are going on in tourism. So I will keep working on those. But what has really been, and I think tourism history is so engaging because it does, as Drew was pointing out, really allow you to kind of see the interconnections of not just the money, but the social and the political and the inter-American, right? It has this ability to really kind of combine all of those perspectives and to see them interworking and to see them as something that is so very relevant to the present, in general, the present, but in our post-COVID moment, hopefully soon post-COVID moment, I say that with optimism, what tourism is going to look like after that, right? And so I think looking through the lens of tourism history has a lot of potential. And for me, one of the most really compelling things, and Anna kind of touched on this, is the element of imagery, right? Imagery is so crucial to tourism and selling tourism. And I think it is particularly, at least for me, potent in the Caribbean and what that very iconic imagery of a Caribbean vacation looks like. And I think that really is a great push for historians to think more visually, to think about what images mean. And I'm not advocating for stepping into art history in any way or stepping on any toes in that way, but to really think critically, you know, about those postcards, about those ads, what they mean, what they convey, and to an outside world, right? I recently reviewed a book called Brand Jamaica, right? And what is the brand that is being projected outward? And then how do people within country, right, who are, for good or ill, right, within this industry, how are they reflecting back? How are they engaging with those images that have been projected outward? Are they resisting? Are they co-opting? Are they changing? How are they engaging with that set of ideas about their own identity, right? And I think there's a lot to learn within those circuits of brands, quote unquote, and images and ideas about a place and its people that can be really fruitful and powerful for historians and other scholars and people who even just engage in tourism, right? To be able to think through those ideas, even if just kind of a little bit, right? To be a little bit more critical about the places they go, if they do kind of, if and when they do resume that practice.
Thanks, Beth. Well, Beth, Anna, and Drew, thanks for agreeing to talk. And I really learned a lot in our conversation. And I'm really looking forward to reading the future work and projects that you mentioned.
Thank you so much, Stephen. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for having us. It was great.